Accession number 4757, room number 3.
Warrell Reel 3, could you perhaps tell me something about your relations with the Army in Egypt as an Army Cooperation Squadron?
208 Squadron, every winter, used to run a series of courses for Army officers in which they did a considerable amount of flying as well as lecture work in order to train them and show them what we could do for them and for the Army. This was not particularly popular with Army unit commanders, who tended, regrettably, to send on these courses the people that they could best spare and not the people that really ought to come. This, I think, was partly due to perhaps the reluctance of the more senior people in a battalion or a regiment to come and live with the rough Air Force. So the younger people used to go on these courses. And when they went back, and one hoped from the RAF side that the commanding officer, soldier, would consult them. In fact, of course, he did no such thing. He went on doing what he thought he should do, or had been doing before. So the progress was somewhat limited. And quite understandably, we had not a limitation as far as aeroplanes were concerned, but we had a limitation during air exercises with the Army on the number of sorties that we could fly per day. This was not because we couldn't fly more, but because it had been laid down into service that when you were flying to look over the hill for the Army, you could only have so many sorties from so many aeroplanes. And this information didn't seem to percolate down to the unit level, because I remember one particular exercise when I was looking after one Army commander, and he could only get 4 sorties a day out of me with my limited aircraft, according to the rules. And he couldn't see why we couldn't fly our bottoms off from dawn to dusk, when his soldiers were tramping about the desert from dawn to dusk and all the night as well. So that relationships could have been better, but I think it was possibly the guidelines laid down higher up were not as clever as they could have been, but also I think the selection of the wrong soldier to come and learn about the Air Force had something to do with it as well. But there were some enlightened ones. The best people that we had cooperation with were the tank corps. The 6th Battalion was just across the airfield from us, and we had a tremendous liaison with them. And they had a very go-ahead colonel, and we used to do a lot of work with them. And we used to do a lot of play with them, too. We used to go and drive their tanks, and we used to teach them to have a go at flying aeroplanes on the quiet. And quite a number of the tank officers that I met then actually transferred to the RAF, because they had a scheme then that an Army officer could come and fly as an RAF pilot. He'd be trained at one of the flying training schools like Sealand or Aboussouair in Egypt, and he would come and fly with the RAF. I think it was for either 2 or 3 years, it might have been longer, before he went back to regimental duties. And then a select few could come back, be refreshed on an aeroplane, and come back and be a flight commander. And some of those that did that reached the honorary rank of flight lieutenant in the RAF, because they still kept their own uniform, before they reached the actual rank of captain. Such was the sluggishness of promotion in the Army. In fact, I had, for my sins, one Army flight commander who I will not name. But he was a dead loss. He was a good pilot, but he was a dead loss. I had to carry the flight for him for about 6 months. And of course, everybody else led him, including the flight sergeant and the airman and everyone. However, I haven't mentioned who travels in the back seat. Well, we did have a number of airmen who were volunteer air gunners, and they used to get their practice, both with camera gun and actual firing, in their turn to the number of hours allotted, both, as I say, camera gun and with live ammunition. They volunteered for this as extra duties. They could be a fitter or a rigger or even a clerk, the flight clerk, or the storekeeper, or anybody. They got a little extra money for this. And of course, we did have wireless operator air gunners as well. And as I mentioned earlier, our wireless sets worked quite well. But just when I got to Army Co-op work in Egypt, they decided that any messages which were to be passed to the Army or received from the Army, the procedure should be changed. Up to the time that I got there, if the pilot spotted something or he had to be told something, it was all passed through the wireless operator. He morsed the message or spoke the message or he received the message, and it was then passed a note to you. They then decided that the pilot should take over the Morse key as well as the microphone and also receive into his own ears any messages direct by voice or by wireless. Well, this meant smartening up on one's Morse code to 25 words a minute for send and about 18 for receive. And as I'd spent 2 years in the school officer's training corps as a signaller and didn't learn the Morse code, I had to pull my finger out and get going. Although one did learn a bit of Morse at Cranwell, and afterwards one was never asked to do more than about 10 words a minute. It didn't really matter whether you did it or not. But all of us did achieve this 25 send and 18 receive. And you really felt that you were controlling something instead of passing the message in a cleft stick to the chap behind you for him to deal with. You felt much more into the game. And this, of course, was much better when you were doing a shoot for the Army gunners, because when you got into the right position, you could send your code, KT, or KTOC as we used to call it in those days, you could send it yourself at the exact moment you wanted it. Whereas, however well you trained your backseat wireless operator, you could never be sure whether he might send it a few seconds late, and then you'd be out of position. Well, we used to give flying to any airman from the squadron and off the squadron, flying experience, who required it and wanted it. And from time to time, we used to get sent to us from the Egyptian authorities, likely Egyptian pilots, and we used to have to throw them about a bit and see if they parked the custard or not in the aeroplane, and whether they reacted well, and whether they sort of tottered about when they got out of the aeroplane. But whether it really achieved anything, I don't know. I must say, I remember flying two or three of them, and they all seemed pretty dim, but they didn't fall about, so presumably they eventually became pilots for the Egyptian Air Force, which of course the RAF was running at that time. We had an RAF mission.
How did a pilot communicate with the man in the back seat at this time?
Well, you did have a voice pipe, the Gosport tubes, which you used during training, which was just a hollow tube with earpieces and a sort of mouthpiece, rather like a funnel, a modified funnel, and you spoke into this very closely indeed, and the receive chap held his receive tubes very close to his ears, and you could hear something. All the flying instruction was done on Gosport tubes. But when you got into the Army Co-op thing, you didn't have the facility of speaking on an internal link intercom. If you had a wireless operator behind you or someone else, you had to write him a note. Or, with the open cockpit aeroplanes, he could shout in your ear if you took one side of your helmet off. But you were outside, and I mean, it was a little difficult. But our main communication with the back seat was either he shouted to you, or you signaled to him, or you wrote a note. And of course, inter-aeroplane communication was best left to an archaic thing called zogging, which consisted of sticking a hand outside the aeroplane, out of the cockpit, and giving a long front-to-back stroke for a dash, and a short front-to-halfway stroke for a dot. And you would then morse to each other, preferably using a code which we each had. I mean, you know that when you change signalers, for instance, changing frequencies used to QIC or something like that. Well, if you had the Q code for all sorts of other things, so that you could shorten your message instead of having a long-winded conversation taking an hour and 70 miles, which is about as fast as you were going at the time. You could get a message over and back fairly fast in 5 minutes by zogging.
Was it common to fly the same man in the back seat for any length of time, or were your back seat men changing?
Yes,
you tended to
stick with your air gunner for most things, so that you became a team. But of course, when you went on visits to other places, some of the air gunners had to be left behind, because if your air gunner was a storekeeper or a clerk, then the back seat was required by fitters and riggers, so that the air gunner of a non-technical training had to stay at home. He might creep aboard the transport aeroplane, which was following as the sort of transport train, but they had limited capacity and weight capability, so that they tended to miss out on the trips we did to Iraq and Sudan and around the deserts and so forth.
These trips that you did, what did they involve? Were these were limited operations, were they?
No, it was to give you a change of air and to see how someone else operated in another country, as well as doing practice training, flying a long way in a short time. I remember going across to Iraq on one occasion. We went to Ismailia and refueled. It was nine of us. We didn't take a transport aeroplane with us, so we were entirely self-contained squadron of nine aeroplanes. We flew to Ismailia and refueled. We flew to Ramleh in Palestine and refueled. We flew to Amman in Transjordan again. We flew to one of the pipeline stations on the K line, which ran from Kirkuk. And we refueled at Rukba as well. And on one occasion, we even went into Ramadi, because we had to go on to Hinaidi. It depended on the winds. And when you went into a landing ground which had refueling facilities, the facilities were yourselves. All you found when you got there was a hut, which had been replenished by Shell, possibly by Camel. And one of you carried the key, of which there were many triplicates and quadruplicates, that you would get from the stores before you left. And you would open the padlock, and you would drag out these 4 gallon oblong cans to the number that you wanted, and enter them in the book, what you'd drawn, who you were, and the date you'd drawn it, and so on and so forth. And most important, you put the empties back, because if you didn't, you had to pay for it. And on most of these landing grounds, you found there was an Arab or two turned up who were only too keen to help. And what they wanted was not money. They wanted the empty petrol cans, because these were good containers. They could make them into all sorts of things, even sides for houses and roofs and the lot. And this used to set you back one piastre if you failed to enter in the number of empties that you'd taken out full to compensate. Well, you get to get 100 piastres to a pound, so it wasn't a great loss for the help you got. But refueling was, in these conditions, was always a nuisance. It wasn't the happiest occasion, because first of all, with your radial engines, on the like you had on the Atlas, you had to hang about until they cooled. This wasn't for any better reason, because you had to climb up and stand on it in order to, or nearby by it, to get to the refueling hole in the top wing tank. And what one used to do, you made two holes in the top of the can, opposite sides of each other, the opposite corners. One to let the petrol out, and the other to let the air in, so that you didn't get a glug-glug effect. Well, it was always a moot point whether it was better to be at the bottom, passing the can up, or whether to be at the top, doing the pouring. Because if you were at the bottom, you inevitably got some petrol spilt on you as the chap took it from you, because the cans were always very full. If you were at the top, you always spilt it on your own feet before you managed to get pouring properly. And of course, that was one of the reasons why you let the engine cool a bit, because you didn't want a flash coming along. Well, having stuffed the thing full of fuel again, you then recovered the cans and dried yourself off from the petrol you'd acquired, one end or the other, depending where you'd been standing. And then you had to wind the whole issue up and proceed. And of course, your Atlas had no starter gear. You had to hand swing it when you were out on the in the desert, and this meant that you had to have a minimum of two people swinging the prop, preferably three. This meant turning it over in compression and then doing one, two, three, pull. And you had a starter generator, which the pilot or gunner or whoever was doing, engineer who was doing the starting, which gave additional spark at the right moments, you hoped, to get the thing going. And then you proceed. Of course, you were better off with the Ordex, because you had two handles and two men, one on each side. You could wind this Merlin engine thing. You could get that going in a different way. Personally, I always felt that prop swinging was a quicker start. The other one depended how skillful the pilot or engineer sucking in and so forth got the mixture right. You could have to wait and let the whole thing drain off and dry out. But of course, when you were on your own airfields at Cranwell and at home, all the aircraft there had a claw front, like a sort of bayonet type fitting on the prop boss. And the aircraft used to be started by a T model Ford, which had been modified by one man called Hux, and this used to twirl the airplane, twirl the engine round, and get the motor started with minimum effort, which you've probably heard about. Hence the expression in the Air Force that not better than a slap in the belly with a wet fish, but better than a tweak in the navel with a Hux starter. But it was a remarkable instrument modification on the T-model Ford. Well, we clattered across to Iraq, and then we split up on this particular thing. One flight went south, one flight stayed in Hinaidi, and we went. Well, I went up with the CO to Mosul, where we stayed 2 or 3 days and flew about in the mountains there, up around Roan Duz and up onto the Turkish border. And then we flew back to Hinaidi, where we stayed a few days. And then we regrouped and we flew back again. In fact, we flew back having refueled several times on the way, but we, by starting off at the very first light, we did Cairo inside the day. We were all pretty tired out, but we got there. Then we did, I think I went to Iraq and one other time. I certainly went down to Sudan, to Khartoum, just to Khartoum once, and round the part of the Sudan once. And of course, there was quite a lot of refueling going down the Nile to get there and back again. You had to land at Assiut, Aswan, and Luxor, and Wadi Halfa, and then when we had the Atlas, we had to land in the middle of that big bight where the Nile goes off to the west, on the railway line, a place called Station 6, before we got to Attleborough. And there was another landing ground we used as well, whose name I forget. I think it was north of Attleborough, Cosima or something, and then into Khartoum. And then you clatter all the way back again, with the Atlas achieving about 70 to 75 miles an hour.
When you converted from Atlas to Audax, was that a conversion from radial to inline engine?
Yes, it was.
Did this make a difference in operations apart from the starting procedure?
Well, it produced additional cooling problems. We had to modify the wind-in, wind-out radiator to provide additional cooling. And I think this was done with canvas and elastic, as far as I remember, to deflect the, or keep the flow on the radiator. And we had, of course, larger and more protuberant oil coolers, both on the Atlas and on the Audax.
You were still with Number 208 Squadron when the Abyssinian crisis started.
Yes, I was indeed.
What effect did this have on the squadron?
Well, the beginning of the crisis resulted in Mirza Matru being opened as an RAF base, and around there, of course, an army base as well. And two flights of the squadron moved up there to spot for the army and to do border patrols with Libya, which was then an Italian-run outfit. I stayed in the flight which was back at Cairo, supposed to be the fighter defense of Cairo with four airplanes, as well as cooperating with residual soldiery in the area. So an additional squadrons came out from England, and they were up at a landing ground called Amria, which was just west of Alexandria. And we had additional squadrons all over the place, down in Sudan and in Egypt itself. And training was stepped up, and more fuel was bought, and generally one began to prepare for possible hostilities. I should mention, perhaps, that for about 2.5 years I was a squadron motor transport officer, in addition to flying. And we had a hell of a lot of transport. I think we had something like 40 to 50 vehicles. This was because we were supposed to be mobile and follow the soldiers around. And if they wanted to go and live in the desert for a long time, we were supposed to be self-supporting with all our own stores and petrol and water and fuel, food and workshops and photographic workshops, the lot. And trouble was, of course, that no one had done very much research into desert travel, as I found when I got there. And what you really needed to do was to reduce the pressure by half in the tires in order to proceed at all, because they were all UK vehicles for UK roads, and also reduce your load by half. And this, of course, didn't add up at all. If you were trying to move a squadron, you'd only get 50% there at any one time. So we did a lot of training ourselves and each other in desert training, and the best de-sanding instrument we had of getting a vehicle out of soft sand was to get everybody on the end of a rope and pull him, because if you put another vehicle on, it merely means you had a second one ditched because you broke the crust and your back wheels went in. So we had a lot of trouble with UK type vehicles. We had also had a lot of fun. And we used to wander about the desert and try and find out how to do things. One of the things I discovered, of course, was that someone further up the line in a headquarters said that the petrol consumption of every engine in a vehicle was set to 12 miles to the gallon, or 16 miles to the gallon, or 25 miles to the gallon, and no deviation was permitted in the logbooks. And the way they used to do this was to filch a little petrol from the aircraft tanks or the filling points in order to square the books. Well, it was no good continuing with this. I blew the roof off this one and said that we were going out on an exercise. We took all the petrol bowsers and cans that I reckoned we needed, and we came back and we found that a six-wheeler towing a trailer was doing 2 miles to a gallon. And when I sent it in, of course, the roof came off at Middle East headquarters, but then I got the equipment officer to come out on a run with me and let him do the refueling. Or he's known as a stores officer, and they let him do the refueling. And then the thing was sort of written up more sensibly, that your consumption depended entirely on the conditions.
So in fact, you were both a pilot and the motor transport officer. There wasn't a separate man responsible.
No. It was an extra duty, in the same way of being mess secretary was an out of working hours activity, or in working hours. I mean, if it was raining or something, or you weren't required, you could always go down and this. But my MT section was right next to my flight. I could nip over for half an hour and sort things out, and then go back and fly. But when I went on trips, of course, I did no flying at all. But I always used to arrange for aeroplanes to come out. They used to come out with fresh rations and beer and the mail, and I always used to borrow them and do a reconnaissance to see which way I was going and which was the best way. Half an hour spent doing that used to save me untold misery dragging aeroplanes out of soft sand. We used to go out quite far into the west, and a lot of it, I think, was kept in being later on. It must have been quite useful to others who had to run vehicles out into the desert when it was really wanted. We were only just sort of, I won't say playing at it, we were basic training on it.
You mentioned during the Abyssinian crisis that you were part of the flight which had been left behind for, among other duties, the air defence of Cairo. What training did you have in air fighting, and just how viable would 4 odd axes have been as the air defence of Cairo?
I think it would have been pretty embryonic, but I did have my experience from my time with the Fury and in one squadron. One I think would have perhaps had some success if any hostiles had come through. I just don't know. But I mean, 3 aeroplanes couldn't do anything anyway, even if we got the information in time, because there was no observer corps. It would merely have been if you happened upon somebody.
There were no fighter aircraft around.
Well, there was a squadron at Amrea, but they were really being held for any work that they might be called upon to do should the Italians have come through from the Italian border in the Saloum area. They were not there specifically for Cairo, no.
Was there any feeling in the RAF in Egypt at the time that there might be war with Italy over this Abyssinian crisis?
Well, I suppose we thought there might be war, yes. I mean, we thought very much about it. We just had a job of work to do and we just got on with it. We were the same way that later on. You accepted the facts that you had to do this, that, or the other, the same way that the soldier or the sailor has to get on with his basic trade. I didn't think anybody was frightened about it, no.
Now, after you'd been with number 208 squadron for nearly 3 years, slightly more than 3 years, you were posted to a rather less normal RAF unit. If you'd like to describe
what was called the RAF Lifting Company, MT Lifting Company. This consisted of 2 officers with Ford pickup trucks as personal vehicles, which you drove yourself, and 40 Ford, light Ford trucks, which had been purchased by the RAF to take stores up into the western desert and dump them at Matru and other places up there. The army were having a hard time in Palestine and they wanted transport. And instead of handing over these trucks, which would have been much simpler really, the RAF decided that they would keep the unit themselves and dispatch them by road or by desert and have them on loan to the army. And this unit formed at Abu Kir, which was the RAF depot those days up near Alexandria. And we drove to Cairo, we drove to Suez, we crossed the Suez Canal by the primitive ferry, two at a time. And then we drove across Sinai into Palestine, and then up through the middle of Palestine to Jerusalem, and were based on Mount Scopus with the 2nd Battalion of Beds and Hearts. And there we were, the motor pool or transport for this battalion, and they were mostly employed during the 1 month I was with them on night raids. This consisted of going out with a Palestine policeman to a certain village, creeping up on it by night, having driven there in the dark without lights or as few lights as possible, and making a raid on the village and trying to see what arms they had and take them off the Arabs, because we were then fighting on the Jewish side. We achieved very little success as far as the soldiers were concerned. We got a great deal of experience in driving without lights around the Palestine hills without breaking a vehicle in the 1 month I was with them. I think on more occasions they lost some arms rather than acquiring any, because they dropped them falling down a hillside. It was all rather futile, and I was very glad to leave it after 1 month when I was posted away back to England to take this Chinese course.
You presumably had this posting in the first instance because you had been an MT officer with your squadron.
No, I think it was rather like the army officer who sent the most easily losable chap. I was due to be posted, and for my last month they could do without me. So I just went. I just had to go. I protested about it, but they said, no, you do it.